by talking about realism in the form of hidden variables. So if you'll remember back to the very first lecture, we talked about the quantum measurement problem, which is a problem for the kind of realism that you have in the orthodox or textbook approach to quantum theory. And we talked about different alternatives for trying to achieve realism. One of them was to deny that psi was a complete representation of the physical state of affairs. And then I made this distinction between two different kinds of hidden variable models. So next week, I'll be telling you about Bohmian mechanics. The first kind of hidden variable model actually allows you to have a full interpretation of the formalism. So there's some interpretations that are on the table that are of this first sort. The second sort is more of a research program. Right? So we don't currently have psi epistemic hidden variable models that really do justice to all of quantum mechanics. However, the second sort is a bit more compelling. It makes a bit more sense. So I'm going to try to explain hidden variables by starting with the second sort of hidden variable model to give you a flavor for why anyone would want to try this approach, because it's the more compelling approach. Next week, we'll come back to the first sort of approach. OK, so as I mentioned last week, one of the nice things about having an operational formulation, a complete operational formulation of quantum theory, is that this is now a target for any interpretation. So what we want to say is, can we have a realist interpretation that reproduces these kinds of statistics here? So the way that a hidden variable model is going to do that is as follows. If you have a preparation procedure in your lab, and last week we said, you know, this is just a list of instructions and we shouldn't analyze it any further. But a realist is going to say, no. We can say more. We can say that this device emits a system, and that system has some physical properties. So a hidden variable theorist will posit, or a realist will posit, that there's some space of physical states. And really, it doesn't matter what that space is. You know, as a theorist, you're welcome to construct whatever space you like. So in this graphic, I've just assumed it's a one-dimensional space, and I label the states as lambda. And then when you get a system out of this box, you can say, well, maybe it prepares the system in a particular lambda. But more generally, it could be that if you only know, you know, what's been done in the lab, maybe you don't know exactly what lambda is. Maybe all you know is that every time you press this button, a system comes out whose physical state is one of these lambdas with certain relative probabilities. So the frequency of getting a system with, you know, the lambda at the peak here is higher than the frequency with which you get systems with some other lambda. So the most general thing you could associate with this preparation is a probability distribution over the physical states of the system that you've posited. So you demand that these mu of lambdas are just positive and normalized. It's a measure over the space you've assumed. So that's what the realist will say, generally, that a preparation procedure does. A measurement is similar. It says, you know, rather than just saying this is a list of instructions that is unanalyzed, you say, no, what a measurement does is it reveals something about the physical properties of the system that you've fed into that device. So you could imagine, for example, that a measurement device tells you precisely what lambda is. That would be sort of an all-powerful measurement device. Nothing would be left unknown. Or you could imagine maybe it partitions the set of lambdas into different regions. So different outcomes of the measurement tell you the physical state was in this region or it was in this region and so on. But even more generally than that, you could imagine that the particular outcomes of this device aren't even determined by the physical state that comes in. There's still some randomness, perhaps due to something in the device. You know, there could be coin flips inside the mechanism of the device. So over here, for example, I imagine that if I feed in a lambda of this value, then there's some probability of getting the first outcome, some probability of getting the second outcome. These xis are just the probability of getting outcome 1 in a measurement of m, given that the physical state was lambda. So here, for all these lambdas, you definitely get outcome 1. You definitely don't get outcome 2 or 3. Here, there's some probability of 1 and 2. Here, there's some probability of 2 and 3, and so on. So these three guys are conditional probabilities, outcomes given states. They have to sum to 1 at every lambda. That's this condition. And they have to be positive. Yes?
So are we assuming here this hidden variables are not, this realistic model is not something beyond quantum mechanics?
Here, what we're trying to do is construct a realist model that at least reproduces the predictions of quantum mechanics. Once you've got that, you could then say, you know, could I go beyond quantum mechanics? Are there ways either of modifying this model such that I get different predictions, or could it be that this model somehow, in addition to allowing the quantum predictions, ought to allow something more?
That's not what I meant. What I meant was that a mu p of lambda is not the square of the wave function.
No. Right, so lambda is a label for some kind of space of physical states which may have nothing to do with Hilbert space. So I'm going to show examples in a few minutes where that space is clearly not Hilbert space. You can think of it as maybe phase space, right? So maybe you can start your day by trying to come up with a hidden variable model where the thing that's hidden is phase space. There's a position and a momentum, and what a quantum state is a probability distribution over position and momentum. We'll talk about that later as well. Other questions? Yes, Ante.
You said that here a measurement would be something that reveals something about the physical properties of the system. So in this model, would the system have some specific physical properties independent of any measurement?
That's right. Yeah, that's the that's a kind of realism, and that's the kind of realism that we're going to be exploring here. Systems have physical properties. You can think of that as, there's a space of physical states. Different ways of parameterizing that space will give you different ways of describing the system. So if it is phase space, things say it has a property of position, it has a property of momentum, and perhaps I can build a measurement device that reveals what its position is. So that would just be a measurement device that reveals a property of the system. Yes?
So far, lambda could just be some set, or the set of lambda could just be some set of orthogonal basis states, right? Like it's either in one of them or in the other.
I suppose you could make your physical state space correspond in some way to Hilbert space, like say the rays in Hilbert space. But then there's nothing hidden, right? So if you say, you remember the orthodox interpretation on day one, the assumption was that psi is a complete representation of reality. So you could say, right, the points on the surface of the Bloch sphere, those are all the different kinds of realities there are. But then you run into all those problems we talked about on day one, like the measurement problem and the inconsistency between deterministic and indeterministic dynamics. So in attempting to solve those problems, we're here going to imagine that, maybe the quantum state is part of the description of reality, but it's not the whole description. There's something more. And here I'm just trying to set up a framework. So I'm claiming that, any kind of realist model you want to write down is going to meet this kind of description. And let me note that, even if you weren't considering hidden variables, if I made this state space here, this set of rays in Hilbert space, then I could still represent things by a distribution. It would just be a delta distribution, right? If my preparation corresponds to state psi, then I have a delta distribution located on the ray corresponding to psi. So this is a very generic framework for describing those kinds of models. Good? Okay, so this is the way that you're going to represent preparations and measurements. Now let me say a bit about, this is how you're going to recover the probability. So it's one thing to write down a bunch of distributions and a bunch of response functions. I'll call each of these a response function. It's the conditional probability associated with the measurement. But to really reproduce the predictions of the operational theory, you'd better get the statistics right. So in this model, the probability of getting outcome k in this measurement is just the probability that you've prepared physical state lambda given that the preparation was p, times the probability that you got outcome k given that the physical state was lambda, summed over lambda. So this had better reproduce the operational statistics in order for this model to really reproduce quantum theory. So this is a constraint you have to satisfy. You can also ask how ought the transformations to be represented. And it's basically as another conditional probability. It says a transformation is going to take a physical state lambda as input, and it's going to output the system in some possibly new state, lambda prime. And it could do that deterministically. There could be a one-to-one map from lambdas to lambda primes. Or it could introduce some noise. So it could be that this transformation T is associated with some conditional probabilities. So this gives me the probability of an output lambda prime given an input lambda. They just have to be positive, and if I integrate over the final states lambda prime, I should get 1. So here's just a kind of schematic. For every lambda, I've got some distribution over lambda prime. So I can imagine different lambdas would add different amount of noise. And again, it's up to the hidden variable theorist to construct this sort of thing so as to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics, right? So quantum mechanics says that if I put a certain kind of transformation, it's going to change the statistics. You'll have to find conditional probabilities that do exactly that. So we won't be talking much about these, but you know, if you really want a complete hidden variable model, you'll need to specify transfer functions for each transformation. And you'll also need to specify the transfer functions for transformations that are induced by measurements. So this is, again, one of the topics that we didn't go into depth into last week, but every measurement, if it leaves the system afterwards, is associated with a set of transformations now, one for every outcome. And so for each outcome, you could imagine having one of these transfer functions that would tell you how the physical state of the system changes. Okay, so before I give you some specific models to give you a better feeling for how these things work, it's important to recognize the difference between what's real and our knowledge of reality. In this discussion of hidden variables, that distinction is going to be critical. So there's this really nice quote by Jaynes criticizing our understanding of quantum mechanics. This is a quote from, I think, the 60s. "Our present quantum formalism is not purely epistemological. It is a peculiar mixture describing in part realities of nature, in part incomplete human information about nature, all scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr into an omelet that nobody has seen how to unscramble. Yet we think that the unscrambling is a prerequisite for any further advance in basic physical theory, for if we cannot separate the subjective and objective aspects of the formalism, we cannot know what we are talking about. It is just that simple." So if that quote doesn't move you, then I ask you to look at his haircut, because as a friend of mine once said, that's a haircut you can set your watch to. So I think he gets a certain amount of credibility just by that look. Okay, so there's these two terms, ontic and epistemic, which are going to come in handy. They come from the Greek, meaning reality and knowledge, respectively. So just to make things simple, I'm going to use them to describe states. So ontic states are going to be real states of affairs. Epistemic states are going to be states of knowledge, so specifications of some agent's knowledge. So a case where that distinction is really clear is in a classical statistical theory. So if I write down a phase space, position and momentum, then a point in that phase space is an ontic state. It's a complete description of the properties of that system. It tells you what the real state of affairs are. But if I write down a probability distribution over that phase space, that probability distribution is not a description of reality. If I look at the relative height of two points in that probability distribution, there's nothing in the world that corresponds to that ratio. That ratio is a statement about my relation to the world. It says, I deem this physical state to be this many times more likely than this other physical state. So it's really a statement about me and my knowledge. Okay, so it's a very different kind of beast, the probability distribution, as opposed to the physical state. You can also distinguish parameters that are ontic from parameters that are epistemic. So this would be, for example, a parameter such that if I vary it, then the real physical state of affairs varies as well. So the position of a particle is an ontic parameter, because if I vary its position, then I'm varying the real state of affairs. Whereas an epistemic parameter might be, for example, the probability distribution at a given point. I can vary that parameter, and it's changing a statement about what my knowledge of reality is without changing reality itself. So, for example, two different people who have different descriptions, different knowledge of reality, the parameters are required to describe their knowledge are different, but the reality might be the same. They might be describing exactly the same thing. Okay, so before going on to the details of this, I thought it'd be fun if we just tried to get a little bit clearer on this distinction, because as I said, it's a critical one. So this is just kind of an open-ended discussion. I'll set up a bunch of terms, and then you can tell me whether you think these things are more ontic or epistemic. So the concept of probability, is this an ontic or an epistemic concept? I'm hearing epistemic whispered everywhere. Is there anybody who has a problem with the notion that this is an epistemic concept? About reality, yep. That's true. I mean, I think that's a good intuition to have, that unless you're entertaining some very bizarre theory wherein, you know, the state of my brain might influence the state of that particle, if you're going to dismiss that possibility, then, you know, epistemic concepts are such that they shouldn't influence reality. My knowledge of reality should not have a direct influence on it. Let me take another point while you're thinking. Good. Yes. So there are some people who would claim that it's possible to have an ontic concept of probability. In particular, Karl Popper argued for what he called propensities, which are kind of objective chance, right? So he says objective chance he would characterize as a situation where, you know, nothing in the world that determines what's going to happen next. You know, there's some genuine stochasticity in the world. And it's not because you're unaware of what the past state was, but rather it just, you know, happens. And on day one, I pointed out that, you know, in the textbooks you'll read that measurements in quantum theory are supposed to be of that sort. They're supposed to be objectively indeterministic. So in the orthodox approach, probability would be more of an ontic concept rather than an epistemic one. But for the purposes of our discussion today, we're going to take probabilities to be describing ignorance. Okay, what about correlation? System A is correlated with system B.
Isn't this quite up for debate?
I'm sorry?
It's quite up for debate, right?
Actually, all of these are going to be a bit up for debate, yeah. But what's your thought?
Well, my old tutor is studying this right now. So
I'm sorry?
My old tutor is trying to argue that there's some, like, ontic relation between in correlations of systems, but right, yeah, I think he's leading the general view is that it's understanding.
And what's your thought?
I don't know, we only have the maths so far, really, don't we? So it doesn't really come in.
Okay.
It depends on how much correlated they are, right? If there's a perfect correlation, then
then it's what? So,
well, if one system really predicts the outcome of another system,
yes,
then it's a statement about reality. Because once you know,
okay, all right. So it sort of has the flavor of a statement about reality, doesn't it? You know, that there's sort of. So it seems like a statement about the kinds of things that are going to happen. Yes. Okay, well, keep thinking about it. I'll take another.
You have things that are correlated, right? You can have reading one that implies exactly what's happening with the other. I guess this is kind of what Minus says with perfect correlation. So isn't that implying that one thing will tell you the reality of another, and therefore it would be ontic? But it's partially epistemic because it tells you if it's not a perfect correlation, then it would be probabilistic, right?
Okay, so you're saying that perfect correlations will be ontic, but imperfect correlations are going to have an epistemic flavor to them.
Yes.
Okay, let me keep taking ideas before I comment on this.
No, I think correlation is immediate. It's not ontic. So you can have two things happening in different parts of reality.
Okay, so you say something like, if a statement that these two things are correlated is a statement about my knowledge, a statement that these two things are causally connected would be a statement about reality. Okay, let me take Schmidt first. So since that kind of statement is, it implies, I think that just way of speaking implies that you think correlation is an object concept. Because you say, just because you think A and B are correlated doesn't mean they are correlated, right? So you're saying being correlated is a way for A and B to be, not a way for you to think about them. So I think there's a commitment to it being an object concept if you want to make that fly. Go ahead.
So I think that correlation is basically something that comes from probability itself. So if you think probability is an epistemic thing, it's epistemic, and if it's object, then it's object. But also, I forgot to ask about
Okay. If I write down a correlation, say in a classical theory, it's a probability distribution. So for example, if I have two bits, they both can take the value 0 and 1. So here's a correlation that could occur. With probability half, they're both 0. With probability half, they're both 1. Okay, so that's a particular probability distribution over the space of states of those two bits. It assigns probability 0 to the possibility 0, 1, and 1, 0. So it's all on 0, 0, and 1, 1. So that's a kind of correlation. If you think that the probability should be interpreted epistemically, then you can say, well, that correlation is a statement about what I know about these two bits. So my view is that it's more of an if you are taking an epistemic approach to probabilities, then correlation, although it feels like a statement about what's happening in the world, is more a statement about what you know. It says that if you were to update your information about the first system, then you would learn something about the second system. Okay, so it's a statement about inferences between learning something here to learning something there. But in reality, those two bits really are either 0, 0 or 1, 1. And they don't really feel, there's nothing about that probability distribution that's lying there in the physical state of those bits. So that's a sense in which it's more of an epistemic concept. Just comment at the back, I'll take that.
If you have two spins,
yes.
One spin here is up and the other one here is up.
Yes.
Might be that there is no causal relation between them. Like,
yep.
They might be disconnected between no interactions.
Yes.
But if you compute the correlation, you get plus one. And that correlation, like, it's not a statement about what we know or not. Like, if two spins are up, like, the correlation will be one.
Well, if you...
Where does our knowledge end?
I was talking about classical probability distributions, but if you take a quantum state that is just, say, up along the z-axis for the first spin, tensor up along the z-axis for the second spin, okay? And then you compare that to a state which is actually entangled, so something like sum over k, phi k, a tensor, mu k, b. Okay, so that some would argue that this is the quantum analog of probability distributions that are uncorrelated, and this is the quantum analog of probability distributions that are correlated. So here, no matter what measurement I do on the first spin, I don't have any more predictability about the second spin, right? If I measure the z-axis, doesn't matter. I mean, I already knew that they were in this state. So I already knew that the state of B was z up. So whatever predictions I can make about B, I make the same predictions after I've done my measurement on A. So that's a sense in which they're not correlated. Whereas here, doing a measurement on A can teach me things about B. Okay, we'll take last point. We'll take the two last points. Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in favor of an epistemic view on correlation. In Germany, after war, there were lots of storks, because war was over, and there were also lots of babies. So there was a correlation between the number of storks and the number of babies, and so you think, well, you can get information out of that. But really, there was no underlying causal relation, which might infer that correlation is epistemic rather than really ontic.
Okay.
Another analogy.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, an experiment is only ever going to lead to knowledge, not truth, right? So if we're assuming you're doing an experiment, then you can only ever get epistemic results. You can't get ontic results by an experiment. So because we're physicists, we're dealing with knowledge.
That's true. But nonetheless, you know, we can still talk about the distinction, even in the face of experimental uncertainties. We can say, now this concept that I'm using you know, is it meant to describe reality, right? So you know, when I talk about, you know, that the mass of a particle, you know, maybe I can never know that mass, but I can make a distinction between my probability distribution over masses. And that probability distribution characterizes my best estimate to what that the mass is, based on, you know, some experiments I did with my particle accelerator. And I can talk about the concept of the real mass, even though I may not know it. You know, I can put it into my equations. And so what I'm really doing is I'm saying it's important to always keep track of, you know, what kind of concept are you using here. Because in quantum mechanics, in interpretation of quantum mechanics, these things are up for grabs. You know, you have a very different approach if you think that psi is the kind of thing that describes reality directly, as opposed to the kind of thing that merely summarizes our information about reality. But it's true that, you know, when you think it may describe reality directly, you know, it could be that you never come to learn psi.
So it only matters if you can do an experiment that distinguishes the two cases, right? But you can't by definition, because your knowledge is coming from experiment.
I would say the distinction matters even in if there's unavoidable experimental uncertainties.
It's only for your own satisfaction, like it's never going to do anything.
Well, I disagree. It's a question of, you know, if, so here's an example I give in public lectures sometimes. I'll try to make a point here. So, you know, is there anybody who speaks Japanese here? Some Japanese. Okay. Suppose you didn't speak Japanese, and you're in Japan, and you see a billboard, and it has Japanese characters on it and some numbers, and you're trying to interpret what this could mean, and after a lot of research, you know, it changes every day. After a lot of research, you realize that, you know, the first number is the temperature, because every day, you know, you measure the temperature in Celsius and it corresponds to that number. So you're like, okay, I figured out that character is the temperature. And then, you know, maybe you find the next one is the wind speed. And then, you know, the third one, you know, search as you might, you find there doesn't seem to be any property of, you know, the weather on a given day that matches that number. And so then you try something different. You say, well, what if I take the collection of days that had the same number, and I look at that collection of days and see if it has any interesting properties. And you find that, you know, the collection of days where the number was 0.5, half of those days it rained and half it didn't. And, you know, the collection of days where the number was 0.9, 90% of them it rained. And you realize, ah, that number must be, you know, the probability of rain, which is not a statement about the weather on that day. It's a statement about, you know, the weatherman's knowledge of the weather on that day. Or equivalently, it's a statement about the ensemble of days of which this particular day is drawn from. But the point is that that number has a very different interpretation from the other numbers. And realizing that there's that possibility makes a big difference in your ability to interpret it. You know, you might have never been able to interpret that number if you came to the table saying there's got to be some property of the weather system that matches that number. And similarly with the quantum state, if you're committed to the notion that psi has to describe something in reality, as opposed to, well, maybe it describes a feature of an ensemble of systems, then you'll be cut off from certain kinds of interpretive possibilities.
But for correlation, I don't know if it was you were saying, but
yeah.
The thing is, it depends how do you define correlation. Because if you, as I think Felix said about the BBs after a war, it's, if you measure a large system and you measure the correlation between a large number of measurements, this is real. This is a real measurement you did. But if you just have one system, for example, a quantum box, and you don't know what is the outcome of it, and you calculate the correlation between two states before doing the measurements,
mm-hmm.
This is another way of defining correlation. But then it must be more distinct.
OK, I think that brings up a good point, which is that, you know, when we talk about probabilities, some people like to talk of them as applying to a single system. And then you could say, this probability describes my knowledge or my relation to that single system. But another way of talking about probabilities is to say, let's consider an ensemble of systems, a collection of systems that have all been similarly prepared. Then my probabilities could describe physical features of that ensemble. They could say the relative frequency with which a particular property appears in this ensemble is the probability. So there, the probability would appear more ontic, because it's describing the reality of that ensemble of systems. But I would say that it still has an epistemic flavor, you know, insofar as if I draw a member from that ensemble, now the probability tells me about my knowledge of it.
Okay.
Yes?
If you take an epistemic viewpoint, it basically gets rid of the collapse problem right away, right? Because then you have a clear definition of what a measurement is. A measurement is updating of your information.
Yes.
So, and then you know in which case you do what to your probability distribution, your set.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so we're going to see that in when you say take an epistemic approach, you mean to the quantum state psi. Yeah, we'll see that it basically collapse is not going to be a problem in this approach. It'll have other problems, but collapse won't be one of them. So I think I'm going to move on because otherwise we won't get to the end. But I mean, I'm not trying to get to the bottom of these issues. I'm just sort of trying to kind of improve our ability to make this distinction so that we're ready when it's important. So what about determinism? Is that an ontic or an epistemic concept?
Ontic.
Why is that?
Because, I mean, it's something that the system does or doesn't do, whether you like it or not.
Okay. Anybody disagree with that? Yes.
Is assigning ontic or epistemic to these labels, ontic or epistemic?
The concept of classification. Part of this exercise is to show that it's for some cases it may not be clear. It may be that a certain concept has elements of both, or whether something's ontic or epistemic just doesn't apply to a particular concept. That could be, I think I have an example further down the list, so I'll bring it up now. The color red. Is the color red ontic or epistemic?
Epistemic.
Why?
Because different people perceive different color differently. So.
But if you define red as a wavelength, then it's ontic.
Okay, yeah. So it depends, is it red you see? I see red on my screen, or is it red, the number that we've assigned it?
Right. So that seems to be a concept which you can kind of, make an argument. Well, it's got some ontic aspect. It also has some epistemic aspect. So there's, when we talk about red as the wavelength, that's clearly a property of the system. When we talk about red as, the character of my experience as opposed to the character of somebody, or the experience of somebody who's colorblind, then, it seems like more of a subjective concept. So I think there's certainly room for saying, this distinction becomes, that there are concepts which will partake, that will be partly ontic, partly epistemic. For the rest of the talk, I'm going to try to say, here are some concepts which are clearly ontic and some other concepts that are clearly epistemic. So I'm trying to eliminate the vagueness. But it's one of those really confusing things. Probability theory is full of these tricks where, you kind of forget that you're talking about knowledge of reality rather than reality itself. So it's good to practice thinking about this stuff. Yes?
During the evolution of, what does evolve during determinism or deterministic evolution? Is it the state of your mind, or is it the physical system state? Because if the wave function, for example, is the state of your mind, then wouldn't determinism be epistemic?
Good, yes. So you could imagine determinism as a statement about, say, a mathematical entity, saying that, that its value at some later time is fixed by its value at the earlier time. And then whether determinism is ontic or epistemic it can apply to either concept, right? You can have a deterministic evolution of some ontic entity, you can have a deterministic evolution of some epistemic entity. Yes. And in fact, if you look at Laplace's definition of determinism, he actually gave an epistemic characterization of it. He didn't say, so you can give an ontic definition of determinism. It would say, the physical state at time t is unique given a specification of the physical state at time t naught earlier than t. So that's really a statement about counterfactual possibilities. If I consider another world where, the physical state at time t naught is exactly the same, well, then the physical state at time t will have to be the same in that world as in this world. But the way that Laplace put it is, it says, if you have perfect knowledge at time t naught of the physical state, then you can perfectly predict what the state at time t will be. So he was basically trying to characterize it in terms of how your knowledge evolves. But it's sometimes useful to keep in mind these two ways of characterizing determinism. There's the red example. Causality is another example. So earlier we had one vote for causality being an ontic concept. Any other feelings about causality? Yes?
I think it depends on whether there's like a knowledge or a reality that is doing the causing, I suppose.
Right, so my, you know, belief that it's going to rain today could cause me to bring an umbrella.
Right.
Yeah. Good. Now, what about the causation that occurs in the physical world, between particles, for example? Let's say I'm a physicist describing that. Is the causal relations that I'm positing, would you say those are ontic or epistemic concepts?
Well, again, it depends if you're describing the probability of something happening, or you're describing the physical something happening, like this particle causes this one
right.
to move an electric field there.
Right.
That seems more ontic. But you're saying epistemically, this one causes it to move here with a probability something. That's
mm-hmm. Other ideas? Go ahead.
Can be the notion of causality is just the human construction that if we lower the temperature, water freezes, but it might be that that's not the reason why it happened, and it so happens that way, and we just imposed our notion that no, it was because we cold water that froze out, set a pattern in reality. It might be that that's fundamentally no cause.
This, it kind of reminded me of David Hume. So this philosopher, empiricist, who said that causality is an illusion. It's just a habit of the mind to conjoin two things, but there's no corresponding thing in reality. Okay. So in that case, I guess it would be epistemic.
Yeah.
Okay. Subjective. Yeah.
Realize that this is very subjective, but then an operationalist would probably express all these things in terms of results of measurements, and so they would all be
about probabilities and correlations between things. One other here.
Yeah, I say if we say that if we don't give a real character to causality, then it becomes a synonym for correlation, because if we just say all water boils and we get a higher temperature, we call it a correlation. But if we say that's not a real thing, then it's correlation, it's not causality.
So this, Hume basically says, in a modern language, that causation is nothing more than correlation. But there is a strong argument against that. We consider the case of the sun rising and the rooster crowing, constant correlation. But when you say that there's a causal relation, that usually supports some counterfactuals. So I think I've given you guys this example before, that if you change the time at which the rooster crows, you don't expect the sun to rise at a different time. But if you change the time at which the sun rises by moving the crow across the earth, then the rooster, did I say crow? No, rooster. Then the rooster will crow at a different time. So it seems like causation should be something more than correlation. It should support counterfactuals where correlations need not support counterfactuals.
Yeah, but that's just assuming a character of causality, of realist to this, that whatever you do, it will happen. It's not just we observe the ice to valid at some temperature. And if we say it will always do that, then it's assuming a real character, because it will always do that, whatever your statement of mind is.
Sure, but you agree that there are some examples where there seems to be this asymmetry. So the correlation is symmetric, but there seems to be this asymmetry in causation, like my rooster and sun rising example.
Yeah.
So maybe you can get away with an epistemic notion of causality, but you'd have to do justice to that kind of example. Cheaper.
Also, in causality, there's the notion of time involved. One has happened before another, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in correlation, that need not be the case.
That's true. Yeah.
So that would say, it would give it some ontic character, I guess.
Certainly, it wouldn't be merely correlation. Yes.
Is time ontic or epistemic?
it's an interesting question. There's a recent set of papers on the idea of thermal time, and the you know the notion of time that appears in thermodynamics. And I would say there's some of those papers which are giving time more of an epistemic character. Let's end the discussion here. My point is just that you know these are subtle issues. They bear thinking about a bit more. I'm going to try to make the distinction precise where I'm going to use it, okay? And you can try to catch me and object as we go along. So here's the distinction between hidden variable models that I mentioned earlier. So the first kind of model is going to be called psiontic, which just means that it's going to adopt a view of the pure quantum state that it is an ontic concept. The definition is as follows. If you take two preparation procedures, p psi 1 and p psi 2, for different quantum states, psi 1 and psi 2, then in your hidden variable model, there will be some distribution over the physical states, lambda, the ontic states, for that preparation, and some other distribution for the second preparation. And so the model is psiontic if those distributions don't overlap at all. So for example, here, you know, I could imagine as an example, a model wherein you know one axis of the ontic state space is just a specification of psi, the Ray and Hilbert space. But there's some other axes, like this one here, which are some extra variables. So it says that psi is not a complete description of reality. There's some other variables. But when I look at the distribution that I associate with preparing psi, it is a delta function along this axis of quantum states. And so as I vary the quantum state, I'm getting to non-overlapping distributions. So I can come up with more generic examples. What they all have in common is that if you vary psi, you're varying the physical state of the system, the ontic state. So anytime you tell me, okay, I vary this parameter, or the set of parameters that describe psi, and every time I do any variation, my model says that the physical state of the world is changing, then clearly psi has an ontic character in your model. It's not merely describing a change in what you know. It's just describing a change in reality. Is there a question over here about that? Or no? The second kind of model is just one that's not psi-ontic. So it's psi-epistemic. And a model of psi-epistemic, if you can find any pair of distinct quantum states such that the probability distributions associated with preparations of those quantum states do overlap somewhere. Okay, so they're not equal to zero for some lambda. So what this means, here's an example of it, right? So psi 1 could be associated with this particular distribution over some physical state space, and psi 2 could be this distribution. So there's some region of overlap. And what it means is that it's possible to imagine varying psi while imagining that the ontic state has not varied at all. So for example, it could be that the reality is that you know there's some point in the overlap describing the physical state of the system. And now an observer, you know, one observer described what they know about the state of the system by this distribution, another observer described it this way. An observer could change their opinion about the distribution while the physical reality is not changed at all. Yes?
State is just a statement about our knowledge.
Yes.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, it'll be a difference in how much knowledge you have. So a pure state will be a state of incomplete knowledge. But a mixed state will be a state of incomplete knowledge where you have even less information. You'll see. Yes?
So in the psi epistemic models, we assume, like, if there's a spin half particle sitting somewhere, we assume that it actually has a definite spin, we just don't know about it. Right?
No, not necessarily. It could be that the properties we're used to thinking about, like spin, aren't the ones that describe the physical states. So it could be that, you know, the physical state space I posit for a spin half particle doesn't, you know, its axes are not spin along Z, spin along X, but something different. And hopefully I'll have a chance to give you an example of that eventually.
But in some phase space, it actually has a definite, like it's a definite point in phase, or some sort of space.
The quantum state is a definite point? No, that's, are you describing a psi-ontic or a psi-epistemic?
Psi-epistemic.
So no. It would be a distribution. It would have to be a distribution.
Isn't your knowledge a distribution?
Well, what it's saying, a psi epistemic model is a model that says psi is a description of your knowledge of the system. A psiontic model is one that says psi is a description of reality.
Right, so in a psi epistemic model, the particle has a definite state without psi being definite.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Right.
And in the psiontic model, the particle, in fact, does not have a definite state because psi is the actual physical state. Is that a
In a psi-ontic model, you might need to specify both psi and some other variables in order to specify the physical state completely. So here was my example where maybe this axis varies over, say, points on the Bloch sphere, and this axis varies over some other variable. So if I want to completely specify the physical state, I need to specify psi, and I need to specify something more. Whereas over here, if I want to completely specify the physical state, you know, specifying psi doesn't really help me. All specifying psi does is it picks out some, you know, subset of the states, but another psi might pick out an overlapping subset. So psi is not one of the parameters that will help you specify the full physical state. Yes?
Which one is Einstein's view in EPR personally?
It's not clear exactly what Einstein had in mind. I actually wrote a paper arguing that Einstein was promoting these kinds of models, not these kinds of models. But I would say that, you know, the textual evidence in favor of that interpretation is not decisive. I mean, Einstein was certainly arguing that psi was an incomplete description of reality, but you know, you can have psiontic and psi-epistemic models, both of which meet that description, right? Because this one adds extra things, and this one just interprets psi as somebody's knowledge, description of somebody's knowledge. So let me give you a couple of examples, and hopefully the distinction will become a bit clearer. So these are some old proposals for hidden variable models of a qubit, a two-dimensional system, where you're only looking at pure states and projective measurements on the qubit. So the first one is due to John Bell, and it was cleaned up a little bit by David Merman, so I'll call it the Bell-Merman model. And the idea is the following. For every qubit, the physical state space is two spheres. Okay? So clearly, the physical state space is not the surface of the Bloch sphere, because that would just be one sphere. It's a pair of spheres. So I'm going to call the points in the first sphere by the vector u, and the points in the second sphere will be specified by a vector u prime. So in this model, every preparation procedure is going to have to correspond to a probability distribution over those two spheres. And so if I look at the state which is spin up along the n-hat axis, the Bell-Merman model says that the distribution that should be associated with that is the following one over u and u prime. It's a delta function at n on the u-sphere, and it's totally uniform over u prime. That's it. Measurements also have to be represented in the model, so remember, I have to get a set of response functions. So for a measurement along the m-hat axis, the up outcome has to be associated with a conditional probability, the probability that if the state is specified by u and u prime, then I get the plus m outcome. And so this model posits that this response function is 1 if u and u prime are such that their sum dotted with m is positive and 0 otherwise. So only for certain values of u and u prime will you get the positive outcome. And for the other values, you'll get the opposite outcome. So it's hard to draw what this thing looks like on the pair of spheres. So instead, suppose I just drew a sphere corresponding to u plus u prime. Okay, then the way to respond to represent this response function on that sphere is very simple. It's just basically asking, is it in the hemisphere that's sort of corresponding, you know, if I consider the hemisphere that's picked out by the direction m, is the u plus u prime in the top hemisphere or the bottom hemisphere? That's all that the spin m measurement is asking. So I tried to draw that here by picking out a hemisphere here. This is sort of height 1. And if you ask, well, what's the probability distribution induced over u plus u prime given this kind of distribution over u and u prime? It turns out it's a cosine that goes to 0, so it's peaked around the n-hat direction. It goes to 0 at the equator perpendicular to the n-hat direction. Anyhow, so if you can then calculate what the overlap of this distribution with this response function is, so I just did that here, and if you work it out, you get a half 1 plus m dot n, which, if you remember the Bloch sphere, is exactly the overlap squared between the spin up along the m-axis state and the spin up along the n-axis state. And so this set of distributions and response functions reproduces the quantum predictions. So you could imagine that's what's happening with the spin when you prepare it, say, up along n, is that, you know, you're preparing a hidden variable indefinitely at this point and another hidden variable totally at random. And then when you measure, you're just asking whether the sum of those two guys is in this hemisphere aligned with M or in the opposite hemisphere. And that's what spins are doing. You know, this is a particular picture of what's happening in reality with spin systems. Okay, and note that this is an ontic perspective on psi. Because if I look at this strict definition, it tells me multiply the two distributions, the one associated with a preparation along axis n1 and the one associated with a preparation along axis n2, then by virtue of the fact that they don't overlap on the u1 space, it means that they don't overlap overall. So clearly, as I vary psi, I'm varying the physical state of the system. Okay? Here's the second model. This is going to be the psi epistemic model. This one's due to Koshin and Specker. It's from 1967. So the idea here is if you prepare to spin up along the n-hat axis, then that corresponds to this cosine distribution about the n-hat axis, drops off to 0 at the equator. So it's just an inner product between n and u. There we are. And the measurements are just these hemisphere-like measurements. And we already saw that, you know, this gives you the quantum probability. So now, in this sort of model, if you look at two different quantum states, one corresponding to the axis n1, the other corresponding to the axis n2, they overlap. There are physical states that are in the overlap of these guys. So unless you go to two totally orthogonal directions, you know, that's the only case where in the two distributions fail to overlap. But, you know, for all other pairs, all pairs of non-orthogonal quantum states, they correspond to overlapping distributions. So this corresponds to a psi epistemic model. Because if psi can change without the reality changing, then that must mean that psi describes some agent's knowledge of what's going on. Okay, so these two models have a slightly different flavor. Let me show you something about the connection between them. Which is that there's some sort of extra, you might call them gauge degrees of freedom, that exist in the Bell-Merman model and that have been eliminated in the Koshin Specker model. What do I mean by that? Well, if you look at the Bell-Merman model, it said that the outcome of the measurement depended only on u plus u prime. So instead of thinking about the physical state as, you know, parameterizing it with u and u prime, I could parameterize it with u plus u prime and u minus u prime. And what this says is that the outcomes of measurements don't depend on the value of u minus u prime at all. So that's kind of like a gauge degree of freedom. It's something that I've assumed is there, but it doesn't influence the statistics of measurements at all. And what I drew here, remember, was, you know, how to think about the measurements in the Bell-Merman model in terms of u plus u prime. If I just eliminate u minus u prime completely, then I'm just saying, look, imagine that a spin half oriented along the n-hat axis just corresponds to this cosine distribution over u plus u prime. And that's exactly what Koch and Specker are doing. They're assuming that there's just one variable, and the distributions are cosine distributions over that variable. So you get Koch and Specker by eliminating this extra degree of freedom that you find in the Bell-Merman model. So that you can say that's one, you know, just from the perspective of these models, that's, you know, one vote in favor, perhaps, of the psi epistemic approach. It seems a little bit more economical. But actually, there's, so far all I've done is really describe, you know, what's going on with these. There's many things that can be said about why the psi epistemic models are a bit more intuitive. So I will move on to that, but I'll pause for questions about those two guys. Yes?
How does one explain, say, two qubits in these models, say, tensor products?
So those two models I gave you have nothing to say about two qubits. So in that sense, they're not interpretations of quantum mechanics. They're kind of toys. They're saying, look, if you thought that you couldn't understand what was going on with just measurements on a single qubit in terms of hidden variables, I mean, these models show you that, yes, you can. You know, you can certainly construct hidden variable models that reproduce the predictions. Maybe those hidden variable models violate some principle that you hold dear, and that's why we shouldn't believe in them. Maybe they can't be generalized to two qubits without compromising some principle you hold dear. They're just meant to illustrate, you know, this is the kind of thing that a hidden variable model ought to do. And so we're going to be talking about all the ways in which it becomes hard to generalize these models and the things you can't achieve for two qubits, like locality, for example. Other questions? Okay, well, let me say a couple of things about evidence in favor of psi epistemic models, and then we'll just continue with this topic next time. So just finish up in a few minutes. So I'm going to go through a few examples of some phenomena that I argue are kind of mysterious from a psi ontic hidden variable model, but natural from a psi epistemic, from the perspective of a psi epistemic hidden variable model. So here's one that you saw in tutorials. If I give you two non-orthogonal states, let's say of a qubit, then it's impossible to discriminate them with certainty. So if I do the optimal measurement for guessing whether the system was prepared in one state or the other, then that probability is always less than one if the two states are non-orthogonal. Okay, so if I take the view that quantum states describe reality, they're ontic, then this is kind of mysterious, because in all the classical theories, for example, if I vary some parameter of reality, some property of the system, then there's always some measurement that can pick up on that variation. So there's, if I have two different states of reality, there's always some measurement that can tell them apart. So if you wanted to approach propose a psi-ontic model, you'd have to say, well, this is something, you know, new with quantum theory. But what I find a little bit troubling is that although you could postulate that, there's also another phenomenon which you saw in the tutorial, which is true of quantum states, which is that there's a three-outcome measurement which tells you, you know, if you get outcome one, it was definitely psi one, if you get outcome two, it's definitely psi two, and outcome three is you don't know. And it's not clear how assuming that you can't discriminate two states of reality would imply that some of the time you ought to be able to unambiguously discriminate them. Those two things don't seem so connected. But if I go to the psi epistemic view, then there's sort of a natural explanation, right? So what does it mean to prepare the state psi 1? It means to prepare a system with a physical state that's sampled from this distribution. And to prepare psi 2 is to sample the physical state of the system from this other distribution. So now, why is it that I can't perfectly discriminate those two states? So your task is to figure out whether psi 1 or psi 2 was the preparation associated with psi 2 was implemented, or the preparation associated with psi 1 was implemented. Why can't you do it? Okay.
Because those states are overlapping, so if I sample from the place where they are console of each other, I can say definitely if it was from one or two.
Exactly, right? Because some of the time, those two devices output exactly the same physical state. Some system in the state lambda. That physical state is consistent with the first preparation, and it's consistent with the second preparation. So even if you had a measurement that could tell you exactly what that physical state was, generally you don't have those kinds of measurements, but even if you did, you still wouldn't be able to figure out which preparation was done. So it makes sense that you ought not to be able to discriminate those two preparations.
So, I mean, and sometimes if you're a realist, that's still kind of unsatisfying, right? Because you can only say things about what you know. You're still not saying anything about a physical state.
Well, if you're a realist, you're claiming that there are physical states, but they're not described by quantum states. So you're saying, we've learned that if we want a mathematical description of the physical state space, you know, we don't look to quantum theory. We have to be more creative, and we have to go beyond quantum theory. And the physical state space is going to be something underlying the quantum state space. So you're not necessarily giving up on reality, but you basically have more work to do if you want to be a realist.
You're giving up on the quantum description.
Yeah, well, in a certain sense, yes. You're certainly giving up on that textbook approach that says that, you know, everything there is to be said about reality is contained in the quantum state. So you're definitely giving up on that if you want to be a hidden variable theorist, yes. Okay, so the second question is, so now it's clear that, you know, whatever measurement you do, you can't with certainty discriminate these two. But can you see how unambiguous discrimination might be possible if this is how we interpret quantum states? So this is a three-outcome measurement. You know, one outcome tells you you don't know, but each of the other outcomes allows you to infer with certainty whether it was psi 1 or psi 2.
Asking how you do it.
Yeah.
Where you just decide the left hand bit before the overlap to one measurement, the right hand bit to the other measurement, and the middle bit to the.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you could do a measurement that would partition this region from this region from this region, then here the only way you could have gotten this outcome would be if it was in psi 1. Here the only way you could get that outcome is in psi 2, and here you don't know because there's an overlap. So again, there's sort of, it's the two things go hand in hand. Whenever you have two things that overlap, you shouldn't be able to discriminate them. But it should be possible to sometimes have an error-free classification of what kind of state it was. So this doesn't reproduce all the phenomenology of discriminating quantum states, but it kind of gives you a flavor for how those two things might be connected in a hidden variable model. Okay, let me give you another example. So something we know from Newtonian mechanics is that physical states will exponentially diverge under chaotic evolution. Right? So you might be familiar with this sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So I have two points in phase space, I have a chaotic Hamiltonian, their distance will become exponentially divergent. But if I look at quantum states, so if I think the analog of a physical state in quantum mechanics is a quantum state, and the analog of the distance between them is the inner product, okay, suppose I made those assumptions, then under unitary evolution, that distance between two states doesn't change. The inner product at time zero is exactly the same as the inner product at time t for any unitary, even if the Hamiltonian that appears in that unitary is in a chaotic regime of the parameter space. So not only is there no exponential divergence, there's no divergence at all. These two states stay exactly the same distance apart in Hilbert space. So some people thought that this was, some people who had an ontic interpretation of quantum states said this is a real puzzle. It means perhaps that, you know, there is no chaos in quantum theory, and then, you know, there's a problem trying to understand how a classical theory can emerge from quantum theory. But if you take the view that these things should be thought of as probability distributions over an underlying state space, then it's not so crazy that this would occur, because the analog of this inner product now is a distance between probability distributions, not a distance between physical states. And so here's a particular distance measure people like to use. It's the take the square root of one distribution times the square root of the other and integrate. So if they're the same, then these square roots disappear and I just get one. So two things that are the same distribution have an overlap of one. If they don't overlap at all, then this product is zero, and this measure is zero. So it varies between zero and one and tells you how close these two distributions are. And Liouville's theorem tells me that the overlap of distributions doesn't change. If I have a Hamiltonian evolution, then the area of phase space in the overlap shouldn't change, and you can infer that this kind of measure doesn't change. So you have exactly the analogous result. For any Hamiltonian evolution, this overlap between probability distributions should stay fixed. And people have asked, well, what's the signature of chaos for probability distributions? And you can look for it. And what they found, for example, is that if you do a small variation in the parameters of the Hamiltonian, then what you can find is that a probability distribution will evolve under one Hamiltonian in a particular way, and under a slightly different Hamiltonian, it'll evolve so that this overlap of the two distributions goes to zero very quickly. So you can get a kind of decrease in the overlap very quickly if you look at these small changes in parameters in Hamiltonian. And so then the natural thing is you could say, well, do we have that kind of chaos in quantum theory? Could it be that if we evolve, psi according to one Hamiltonian and evolve it according to a slightly different Hamiltonian, do I find that the inner product goes to zero quickly? And roughly speaking, that's what they find. So this intuition about how we should think about psi gives you a notion of chaos in quantum mechanics, which works pretty well. Yes?
Sorry, we are taking the inner product in two different systems, then, right?
These guys here?
Yeah.
No, so this is meant to be two quantum states on the same Hilbert space, describing the same system.
Oh, but it'd be evolving with different Hamiltonians.
So, yeah, here this was the case with two different states, same Hamiltonian. I didn't write down equations, but I could have considered a particular psi naught and then asked, what happens under one Hamiltonian, call that, psi of t, and under another Hamiltonian, psi prime of t. How does the overlap between psi of t and psi prime of t evolve? And it goes to zero very quickly. Yes?
What do you mean by chaotic evolution?
Okay. So if I look at a classical system, then I can change the parameters in the Hamiltonian, and I can have what's called deterministic chaos. So there's particular values of the parameters of the Hamiltonian, particular kinds of Hamiltonians. I can find values of the parameters in the Hamiltonian such that I get this exponential divergence of nearby points in phase space.
It requires nonlinear equations, though, right?
No. Sorry.
Chaos needs nonlinear dynamics, but quantum mechanics is linear. So.
Well, what it means is that your Hamiltonian should be a nonlinear function of, say, position and momentum of your system. But I can still write down a quantum version of that Hamiltonian and a unitary associated with that. And that unitary is still a linear operator, right? It still takes coherent superpositions of quantum states to the coherent superposition of their unitary evolutes. So it's a different kind of nonlinearity.
So you can write a unitary operator that enacts chaotic dynamics.
Exactly, yeah. Just as, I can write down an operator that takes a probability distribution over phase space and asks, how does that probability distribution evolve under Hamiltonian but chaotic dynamics? And that operator over distributions will be a linear operator. It'll take convex sums of distributions to the same convex sum of the evolved distributions. So let me stop there, and we'll continue next time with this. Sure, you can ask a question.